Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Emilio Zelko made it her mission to expose political corruption and the far reaches of organized crime into the small community of Joliet, Illinois. But this mission made her a target of those who wanted her silenced. From a secret investigation to the FBI, to Robert F. Kennedy digging for her grave, to dogged reporters keeping her story alive, there's been no shortage of those looking to find the answer to what happened to Emilio Zelko. This is the second part of her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring.
This week, we are joined by Taylor Meskimen.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, last week we covered the disappearance of Emilio Zelko. And before I give a quick summary of where we are, I just wanted to check in with you.
Well, there's a lot happening. We left it with, like, so many ways Emilio could have gone missing. And you did end on the idea that there's no way she's survived, right? Like,
I mean, you know, there's always
Always a way, but, like, for the most part,
yeah,
the people that were out to get her were out to get her.
Yes. I mean, she had developed a very long list of enemies, and a lot of people didn't want her speaking up in the way that she was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I'm going to give a summary, particularly to get us catch everyone up. Now, first, Emilio often went by the name Molly, so in direct quotes, you might hear that name used. Emilio was a 47-year-old woman who had been working for a man named William McCabe since the time she was 17. She'd gone from being his secretary when he was a lawyer to practically running The Spectator, the weekly newspaper he'd purchased in 1936. William McCabe envisioned The Spectator as a place to fight back against local corruption, not just in the city of Joliet, where they were located, but the entire state. McCabe was known for writing scathing editorials about local politicians, and it's likely his involvement with the paper, as well as his bid to get in the Joliet City Council, which led to a brutal attack on him in 1948. McCabe was left with permanent injuries. Both McCabe and Amelia believe that the person who organized the hit on McCabe was a man named Francis Curry. Curry was known as the Thin Man, and he headed up the area's legal and illegal gambling gambits and had connections to the mafia. With McCabe sidelined, Amelia largely took over running The Spectator, skewering local politicians, Curry, and the like for corruption. This included one of the candidates who had been running for sheriff. She also pushed for the ban on pinball machines in Joliet. At the time, pinball machines didn't have flippers, so they were considered games of chance rather than skill, making them a profitable avenue for gambling. Which is to say, if you were involved in corruption or otherwise illegal activity, Emilio Zelko likely had her eye on you. But it also meant that she was drawing a rather large target on herself. Emilia knew this. She thought she was being followed and worried that someone might attempt to attach a bomb to the starter of her car. On the night of September 25th, 1957, Emilia finished up late at the paper. The weekly issue was set to go out the next day, and she promised to return early to approve the front page before it went to print. Sometime after 11:30 p.m., neighbors near the West Buell Street apartment heard a scream, the slamming of car doors and the squeal of tires. Looking out, they didn't see anything and attributed it to teenagers in the neighborhood who had been known to cause noise at night. At 12:15 a.m., a passerby spotted a high-heeled shoe on the ground and placed it on the trunk of a nearby car. That car happened to be Amelia's. The next day, when Emilia didn't arrive at work, two employees went to her apartment and found her shoes, one on the trunk and one in the grass. Instead of the headline she'd planned for the week's issue of The Spectator, the headline read instead, "Molly Zelko Kidnapped." No one would see Emilio Zelko alive again. And now, to pick up where we left off, let's get into the search for Emilia. From the outside, it looked like little headway was being made in the search for Amelia. 3 days after her disappearance, the Joliet police said that they had few clues. They announced that they are taking to the air in a helicopter to do an aerial search of local ravines, but soon they were back, announcing they didn't see anything. Her brother, Dr. Joseph Zelko, a local dentist, told reporters that his own theory was that she had been a victim of a robbery. He asserted that his sister often wore expensive jewelry, including a bracelet that cost several thousand dollars, and of course, her 17.5-carat diamond ring. Dr. Zelko said, "I'm satisfied someone laid in wait for her Wednesday night. They grabbed her and drove off."
There are so many reasons she could have gone missing. The jewelry didn't even occur to me.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
So this was a primary...
There's another one.
Yeah.
Another reason.
Yeah. Like, what could have happened to her, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, even though Amelia Zelko had plenty of enemies, it's entirely possible that she could have been the victim of a targeted robbery, mm-hmm. right? Because you can't discount
right. that. Right. I just hadn't been... My head hadn't been there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because so much else was going on.
So much was going on.
Now, it's late at night when it happens. It's a relatively quiet residential neighborhood. There's not a lot of witnesses around, right? So it's not like that couldn't be true as right. well. Now, this seemed like a logical line of questioning, particularly because where exactly is Amelia's 17.5-carat ring? The ring itself was always a piece of wonder. A lot of people questioned exactly how Amelia could afford it. At the time, it was valued at $37,000, which is several years' worth of her salary. Her friend Alice had an answer to it. Alice said that she's the one who sold Amelia the ring for $5,000 at a substantial loss considering the value. Alice never said why she made this sale, but it did place the ring at just a year's worth of salary instead of several.
But still, it's, yeah, like, why and how?
Yeah.
Where did Alice get it? Is
so many questions.
Yeah.
Now, police doubted the robbery theory because if someone wanted the ring or her bracelet, they doubted that the perpetrators would have basically gone through the hassle of kidnapping the 118-pound Amelia. They could have just done it by force.
Right. I mean, and did she wear these all the time?
Apparently, yeah. So she's okay. regularly out and about.
But yeah, so she's pretty small. They can just take that, right?
Right. Then just take it off her. Her tiny little fingers and,
and run.
Now, the whereabouts of the ring was like the talk of several articles, but soon her friend C.H. Peterson stepped forward to say that Amelia had actually left the ring in his care while she was at the Silver Cross Hospital from August 8th to September 7th. Now, remember, Amelia said it was apparently, you know, he was in the habit of Amelia to check into hospitals and sanatoriums to get some rest. And so Peterson's statements finally ended this line of questioning. The ring has been found. Meanwhile, they began questioning potential witnesses and those who knew her, but they discovered few leads. There was a momentary flurry when her neighbor, a former convict, was brought in for questioning and held for several days while they administered two lie detector tests, but those tests were deemed to be inconclusive and he was released shortly thereafter. For all intents and purposes, it really did seem that Amelia had disappeared into thin air, and with the FBI stating publicly that they were refusing to join the case because there wasn't clear evidence that she'd been kidnapped, it really seemed possible that the search for Amelia stalled rather quickly, at least to the public eye. As the weeks turned into months, it didn't seem like anyone was getting any closer to finding out where Amelia Zelko was or what happened to her. But behind the scenes is a completely different story. Despite publicly stating that the FBI wasn't involved in the investigation, Amelia's disappearance had actually captured the eye of J. Edgar Hoover, then the head of the agency. He ordered the Chicago area office to investigate. With Amelia's opposition to what was then organized crime's control of the gambling in the area, her disappearance had the possibility of cracking open something larger. Amelia's case also caught the attention of Robert F. Kennedy. From 1957 until 1959, Kennedy was the chief counsel to the Senate's Select Committee on Improper Activities in Labor and Management. This committee is often just referred to as the McClellan Committee or the Rackets Committee. Amelia and Kennedy actually had quite a bit in common. The Rackets Committee was designed to root out corruption and fraud, and that included organized crime. Now, Kennedy caught wind of Amelia's case from newspaper reports and decided that he would specifically look into her case. And that's when Kennedy encountered James Rinney. Rinney, known as the Green Hornet.
Okay.
Yeah. he's a pretty low-level figure in the crime underworld. He, along with another man named Alex Ross, often act as enforcers, specifically for the Chicago Independent Amusement Association.
Amusement Association. Are we heading back into, like...
pinballs?
Yeah.
We are.
Are we really?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so last episode, we talked about pinball machines and how they're used for gambling and jukeboxes and how those were used for money laundering, mm-hmm. right? Now, tavern and restaurant owners at the time were pressured to register their jukeboxes and pinball machines with the Chicago Independent Amusement Association. And that sounds like a pretty, like... up and up organization, like something official, but what it was really was operating at the time is just a front for organized crime. Those who registered their machines were required to pay kickbacks to the association.
Mm.
Those who didn't register faced the possibility of someone like James, the Green Hornet, Rennie.
You don't want the Green Hornet after you.
No. And Alex Ross showing up to their establishment. Mm-hmm. Right. So together they would destroy the unregistered machines, sometimes with acid, sometimes with axes, sometimes just by emptying their guns into the machines. So when Rennie was arrested, Robert Kennedy saw the perfect opportunity to press Rennie for information about organized crime in Chicago. Kennedy and Jim McShane, who was a private investigator working for the Rackets Committee, traveled to Joliet to talk to Rennie, who was being housed at Statesville Penitentiary in Joliet. While questioning him about organized crime, both Kennedy and McShane repeatedly asked Rennie about Amelia, and finally he made his confession. Rennie said that he was paid $3,000 to help murder Amelia. He said that he and two other men kidnapped her at her West Buell Street apartment. From there, they drove her north towards a farm near Statesville Prison. He said that's when they shot her. Her body, he said, was buried on the farm in quicklime. Robert Kennedy and Jim McShane drove Rennie out to the farm and started digging where Rennie pointed. As they were digging, the owner of the farm approached and asked what they were doing. I guess they didn't get prior approval. Rennie, though, he had cautioned them that this guy who owned the farm was involved. So McShane jumps in and says, oh, we're digging for, like, rare minerals on so behalf just, of so the state.
No permission. And they're just digging and making up a thing. Okay.
It was, though, enough to get the man to leave. Right? So Kennedy and McShane, they're digging again, but without results. And I guess Kennedy vented his frustration at Rennie because Rennie responded, may I have syphilis of the eyes and may my mother be a whore if she isn't buried here.
Did he actually say that?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, this is a little while ago, but this isn't like...
Oh, because it feels like it came from the
1800s. Doesn't it feel like this feels like a, like, yeah.
Yeah.
Like a Shakespearean type of, like,
right.
comment to make, not something, I mean,
who knew? Where Rennie are we, like, almost
in the 60s here? Are we in the 60s?
Late 50s.
Late 50s, yeah, so.
Yeah.
That was a little dramatic.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was. Apparently, it was also convincing enough to get Kennedy and McShane back to digging.
It did the trick.
Yeah. Now, Kennedy would later recall that the farmer reappeared in the company of his three large sons. It was enough to send Kennedy, McShane, and Rennie racing through the fields to escape. We'll be back in a moment. Later, Rennie was brought before the Senate to answer questions about his involvement with organized crime. He largely pleaded the fifth to all their questions. Later, he'd said he lied about murdering Amelia. That he thought at the very least he'd get some time out of prison while they looked for her, or hopefully that he'd get some sort of deal if he talked. He knew based on their questions that they were really interested in Amelia's case, so he thought this was the best avenue. For Kennedy's part, though, he wrote in his book in 1960, which is titled The Enemy Within, about his experiences of going after Jimmy Hoffa and corrupt labor unions and other organized crime. And in it, he includes looking for Amelia's body at the farm and said that despite Rennie recanting, he still thought he was involved.
Is that because he never got syphilis of the eyes?
Maybe. Right. The whole thing, though, didn't bring them any closer to finding Amelia. So every year or so, the FBI agent heading the Chicago field office would bring up Amelia's case to J. Edgar Hoover and requested that it would be closed. And every year that request would be denied. Despite no new evidence, the potential of Amelia's case to be connected to organized crime was enough to keep it into consideration. Now, soon after, Amelia's case actually faded from public notice. 7 years after she disappeared, her family petitioned the courts to declare her legally dead. By January of 1965, that went through. Legally, Amelia was considered dead, and the rumor network around town suggested the same. Few, if any, believed Amelia Zelko was still alive. And while there have been many whispers about Amelia, many had already forgotten about her until 1978, when a reporter named John Whiteside heard about her story. He brought it to fellow reporter Lonnie Kane, and the two of them began a mission to uncover the truth about what happened to Amelia. This culminated in a series of articles published that year, and through writing it, Whiteside and Kane would interview countless people who knew about this case. One of those people that they interviewed was Joseph Trisna, who had been the police chief in Joliet. When Whiteside and Kane spoke to the then-retired Trisna, he went and collected a paper evidence bag that he had been keeping in his home. Inside were Amelia's shoes. Trisna said that Amelia's friends often warned her about the dangers she faced, and she would reply that if she ever encountered someone, she would kick off her shoes and run. Many thought that that's exactly what happened that night. Amelia disappeared, and that's why her shoes were found. Unfortunately, if that's true, she wasn't able to escape quickly enough. Now, according to the reporters, Trisna said that at the time of Amelia's disappearance, the office was like a leaky rowboat and that no one could be trusted. That's part of why he brought Amelia's shoes to his personal residence, something that typically would not have happened. One of those examples of how leaky the department was during those early days of the investigation, he said that during this time they interviewed 50 different people, and to facilitate this, they'd hired a secretary to take notes shorthand during the interviews. Trisna said that when they were done, the secretary took a vacation to Las Vegas and never returned. Disappearing with her were all of the interview notes.
Oh my gosh, she took everything?
Mm-hmm. Now, the idea that there were problems at the police department wasn't unlikely. When Whiteside and Kane had gone there to get access to the original records of Amelia's case files, they were gone. Hoping to find some clue that was overlooked, Whiteside and Kane actually brought Amelia's shoes to be x-rayed. Trisna had turned over the pair to the reporters, likely hoping it would lead somewhere. The x-ray yielded no clues. It was yet another dead end.
Do we know what they were looking for?
I have no idea what would be hidden in their shoes. I think they were just like, we will try anything.
That's right? So funny. And then, do we feel like it's just like a coincidence that there's no, like the notes disappear, the case files disappear? Yeah. Is that a coincidence or is that deliberate?
I mean, I know that there were some people on that department who, right, when she disappeared, were like actively stating that they were not going to put any effort into looking for her. Obviously, Trisna, who like headed up the, you know, the police force, also had questions about what was happening there. So, yeah, I don't think anything's really coincidence in this.
Right.
Now, as the search for Amelia grew, though, like Whiteside and Kane, they encounter a woman who wanted to share her story publicly for the first time. She said that she'd been witness to something the night Amelia disappeared and was now ready to share her story. To facilitate her now 20-year-old memory, Whiteside and Kane opted to do a very 1970s thing, which was to put her under hypnosis in order to get her story completely. So while under hypnosis, the woman who Whiteside and Kane referred to as Sarah in their original article recalled that she saw four men get out of Gahar on Stryker Avenue in Joliet that night. With her husband away and her kids asleep, the woman cautiously looked out her window. She recognized one of the men as someone who was working on the sewer construction project happening along her street. He and the other workers would often stop by for a glass of water at her house during their workday, so she was familiar with him. Sarah recalled when the men got out of the car, one of them said, "That's one bitch we'll never have to worry about again." As she looked on, the men opened their trunk and took out something bulky that looked like it was wrapped in a blanket or a cloak. In horror, Sarah watched as first one leg and then another slipped out from under the covering and into view. This entire time, Sarah was begging her dog to stay quiet, for her kids to stay asleep, for her husband not to come home early. She knew she was seeing something she very much shouldn't. Across the street, the men dropped the body into a deep ditch that had been dug for a storm sewer pipe and then shoveled some dirt on it. Though they left in the car, they circled back around the block a few times before finally leaving. Sarah spent the hours until dawn hiding inside her laundry room, alternately crying and smoking cigarettes. The next day, the man she recognized showed up at her home. He asked if she slept well the night before, and she answered the only way you can in a situation like that, which is yes. Yes, she did. Mm-hmm. Sarah said that soon after, little things started to be taken care of, like her grocery bill was paid for, and someone gifted her $500 as a donation that she could use for Christmas gifts for her kids. Now, Sarah's story was certainly earth-shattering in terms of finding new evidence in Amelia's case. Later, Kane would say he wasn't fully certain of her story, considering they had used hypnosis, and because in their search for answers, they'd actually also tried other avenues, including psychics. He said his experience with those more unorthodox methods left him less trusting of the story, even though it did have some validity. Records did show that there was a sewage system repair on Stryker Avenue that had actually been underway when Amelia disappeared.
Could they prove anything with, like, the bills that were being paid?
No, I don't think they...
They couldn't trace that? Or...
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay. Now, another thing that stood out to Kane, he said one thing seemed very strange to him, and that was that despite this story running in the local papers, no one from law enforcement ever followed up on the Stryker Avenue angle. And he said that after the first article about Amelia ran, he was fast asleep in bed on that Sunday morning when the phone rang. On the other end was a man whose voice he didn't recognize. The man asked if Kane wrote the article. When Kane said that he had, the man said, "Do you know what you've done? Do you know what you've done?" before hanging up. Kane would later recall that the man didn't seem angry, he seemed afraid. Kane and Whiteside's work uncovering Amelia's story did a lot to bring her case back into the public consciousness, even if it was unsuccessful in rallying law enforcement or finding where she was or what happened to her. Whiteside would actually continue covering her story until his death in 2005. He said, "You pick up those shoes and the molly bug bites you. I feel like I knew her. There's a journalistic bond between us. My bottom line goal was to find her." Today, Kane continues to remember Amelia and his fellow reporters' work on it in his own articles and lectures covering the case. He writes about how at the time they were working on it, they saw themselves as Robert Redford-type characters in All the President's Men and debated over their beers and notes about who would play them in a film.
This would actually make a good film.
Mm-hmm.
Has there not been one?
No.
Not even a documentary?
I don't think so, no.
This would make a really good film.
There's like the podcast series, but there's not more. Yeah.
Okay.
All of that brings us to today. We're now closing in on 68 years since Amelia went missing. It also makes it 47 years since Kane and Whiteside began their quest to share Amelia's story. In these years, surprising little has been done to search for Amelia's body. Kane says that when Whiteside was alive, he'd received a letter from a man who had worked the construction site on Stryker Avenue back when Amelia went missing. The man said that his job was to make sure that the ditch was level and to cover up the section they were working on at the end of each day. But the day that Amelia went missing, he was called off work early. He told Whiteside that he was worried about this, worried that he wouldn't be paid because he hadn't finished the job. In reply, he was told to shut up. Apparently, he got the gist that something was going on and knew enough to keep quiet, like he was told.
Has that spot ever been dug up?
No. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So since then, there has been some analyses of this site using detection tools that can't necessarily find a body, but they can indicate places where the soil layers have been disrupted.
Okay.
Despite finding places on Stryker Avenue that showed that there are areas of disturbances, no one has moved in to dig. There's hesitation because at the Stryker Avenue site, for instance, that would involve digging up the sidewalk and possibly infrastructure. And they believe that if Amelia is there, probably little of her remains today.
Now, but there might be enough to say that she was there, but I guess I can see what they don't want to shut down, like, this whole neighborhood.
To do exploratory
digging. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, last year, there actually was construction on Stryker Avenue, and a reporter from Joliet's The Patch interviewed construction workers. There were two AT&T workers who had been working 2 to 3 feet down installing lines, and they had never heard of Amelia Zelko. A construction worker, though, had. He said they were actually on the wrong side of the street to even have a chance of finding her body, and he didn't believe that the city's intent was to go digging on the opposite side of the road, where she would be if she were there. What we know about Amelia's story wouldn't be possible without reporters and historians who found it necessary to document it and investigate who she was and what happened to her. I'd like to think that Emilio Zelko would have been happy to know that reporters are still out there covering Joliet and its happenings.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Philomena, The Goose Girl, and All the Rest, about Emilio Zelko, 47, missing since September 25, 1957, from Joliet, Illinois, read by Taylor Meskimen. Born in New York and raised in Los Angeles, Taylor is a multifaceted actress and artist. Well-versed across a variety of creative fields with professional accomplishments in theater, film, music, and television. Taylor has been performing live for over a decade at venues throughout Los Angeles when she hasn't been in recording studios, voicing characters for animation and commercials. She has also won awards for her audiobook narrations and has over 130 audiobooks available on Audible. No stranger to artistry and hard work, talent and success run in Taylor's blood. She is the granddaughter of television star Marion Ross, best known for her role alongside Ron Howard in the hit TV series Happy Days. Taylor's parents are also both professional actors, and her mother runs one of the top acting schools in Los Angeles, the Acting Center.
They say it's divine punishment, the cutting out of a tongue, the transformation of a woman into a bird, her voice reduced to a song that no human can understand. Listen, they'll say. The birds are ushering in the dawn with their chorus. What if we imagine the choir is all the women who can no longer speak? Each rustle of a wing, their slim hands reaching out to grasp our own. Each song, a lament that our ears are not designed to hear. A tragedy. We'd sigh if we knew, instead of asking why, in every version of the story, there are those who crave our words. The cold clap of their hands across our mouths, the clatter of our keys growing still. What transformation might happen if we asked why this silencing is in every tale we are told?
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy. Moro Casino.
America's social casino. Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus. Moto Casino. America's social casino. Download the Moto Casino app today.